All stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this special episode of American Vindicta. We have an in-house guest, literally here at the house. And before we get started, we're going to pay a few bills. We're going to talk about our sponsors real quick. If you have any need for buying gold and silver, please visit stevequill.com. Eventually, the economy is going to crash. Gold and silver won't. So visit stevequill.com. Get something useful, because, like I said, eventually your American dollar won't mean anything. If you need to be able to prep, if you need to buy food, camping equipment, stuff that could help you in a doomsday-like scenario or a prophecy-hit-the-fan scenario, visit mountainstatesurvival.com. That's mountain-state-survival.com. And finally, if you need night vision, if you need ballistic helmets, if you need to learn how to better prepare for yourself, your family, and the area that you live in, visit Robert Griswold's site. That's readymaderesources.com. With all that said out of the way, you can go to the AmericaVindictaShow.com and you can find these podcasts on there. It'll direct link you all the way to GSRadio.net, who is the one who holds this this podcast. And we thank GS Radio very much. And Todd does a wonderful job with this radio station. So give Todd some love and check out some of the other podcasts that are on there as well. It's really good material. With that being said, I have a special guest, a good friend of mine named AJ. AJ was a Detroit cop. He also worked for Homeland Security as a contract security guard. We have a lot of commonalities, even though there's a little bit of a time gap in between us. I was a cop for 10 years. AJ was a cop for 10 years. And we're going to let AJ talk a little about what's on his heart. And he's going to share with us some of his experiences and his opinions. So, AJ, with that being said, thanks for being here.
Hey, man, I am glad. I am honored to be here. Thank you so much for having me, sir.
Yeah, it's this is something that we've been talking about for a while. And hopefully we'll have a lot more of this coming because AJ isn't, like I said, he's a diamond in the rough. And we're trying to get him to write a book here eventually. And I'm going to pressure him until he finally does it. So, with that being said, what's our first topic that we're discussing?
You know, one of the things I really wanted to talk about was something that I heard you mention on one of your other shows. You were talking about, why is there such an attack against white men? And I was listening to the show, and I mean, it just started, bombs started going off on the inside of me. For those of you who don't know, I am African American, and Doug and I are good friends. We're both Christians. We're both ex-cops. And I know why there is an attack against white men.
Why?
The Marxist left has taken over the country right now. Marxist groups like Black Lives Matter, and I'm going to go ahead and say it, they said their stated goal is the destruction of the nuclear family. Here's the reason why white men are under attack in America. Not because you're racist. That's the lie that they use. For the most part, white men raise their children. I know there are exceptions to the rule, but the exceptions don't negate the rule. Now, the black community where I come from, the biggest issue is not racism, it's absentee fathers. If you look at the black community in Detroit, Chicago, Philly, everywhere else there's a big major city, you see absentee fathers. The destruction of the nuclear family in the black community has already taken place. So much so that there really is no black community anymore. And I say that because in community, you don't rob your neighbors. You don't steal from them. The things that you see in community, like my grandparents grew up, people looking out for each other, people taking care of each other, you don't see that in the black community. The reason why there's such a hatred against white men is because you raise your children. When Marxists, even people like Black Lives Matter, look at white men, they see God's divine order. Now, here's what I mean. God's divine order for a family is a man, a woman, and children. The black community, you don't see fathers. By the time I was a teenager, Doug, most of my friends, I can count on one hand how many of them actually had their dads in their lives, much less in the home. You go to the state fair, my wife always gets on my case because I sit back and I people watch. When they look at white men, they see families, they see God's divine order. Now, I'm not saying that white men are God. Is that what I'm saying? It's the family structure, the nuclear family, for the most part, has not been decimated amongst your ethnic group like it has mine. They hate that. When you get rid of the father figure, that race or that group is destroyed. I saw it my entire life growing up. No fathers. Look at Detroit. Look at Chicago. We're less than 13% of the population of the U.S. But we're responsible for, 50% of all violent crime?
By the FBI statistics, yeah.
The 10 years I spent on the police department in Detroit. Now, Detroit, of course, was, 96.9% African American. You know, they love to talk about racial disparities. I saw it myself. Most of the people I dealt with, all the people I dealt with in the city were black. But over 99% of the arrests we made, the violent people we took off the street, were from single-parent homes. Black Lives Matter loves to talk about destroying the nuclear family. The nuclear family represents God's divine order. If there's any doubt in anybody's mind if God's original design for the family isn't the right one, all you need to do is look at the black community. You, like me, you've traveled overseas. I've been to Africa, I've been to Europe. What do you see? You see fathers, mothers, and children. I got to Africa, man. I'm like, what? Man, these fathers involved, engaged. It takes two parent structure to raise a child. The Bible says that he charged fathers with nurturing and raising their children in the fear and the admonition of the Lord. There's no fathers in the black community. That's why the hood is what it is. That's why the hood is the hood.
Then why do Democrats come out and say that we need to just go ahead and accept that children don't belong to families, they belong to communities? Because if you see that historically, it never works. When children belong to communities, it turns very tribal. Tribalism in America turns to gangs.
Absolutely. They make those stupid statements because they have an agenda. They want your children to belong to basically the state, if you will. Look at the indoctrination that's going on in the schools. I didn't get taught to hate my country growing up. I didn't get taught about transgenderism and anything that the state is pushing. When I was growing up, my mother, thank God for her. She told us the truth. She taught us right from wrong, as it is dictated in the Bible. I'll say it this way. I can remember when I went to school, and the school I went to, there was white kids, black kids, when I was a little boy. I heard these white kids talking about they're learning auto mechanics from their father. Camping, fishing, all those things. I'm thinking, man. You know, my parents divorced when I was young. My father suffered from mental health issues. He drank. He had a lot of problems. And there was violence in the home. We had to get away from him. I spent my whole life feeling like, man, there's something missing in me. Because I did not have God's design for children in my life growing up. You know, look at the incarceration rate, how it exploded in the black community. Now, and I'm getting this from Thomas Sowell, brilliant guy.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to 1971, 77% of all black children were born into two-parent households. Now, the reverse is true. What happened during that period? The welfare state came along. Black women were convinced, marry the state, don't get married. you started. Now, when even during racial systematic racism, black families stayed together, and you had far less incarceration. You had far less crimes. Heck, my grandparents and my parents used to tell me, "Man," and they were from the South. They went to Detroit, where my brother and I grew up, because of the jobs, and they were from small towns where they couldn't make a living that good. So they left in the late 60s and went to Detroit. They were amazed at the amount of crime, the amount of lawlessness. They were like, we didn't grow up like this. We used to leave our doors unlocked. They had actual community. But what they had also in that community with those fathers was the God factor. I love to call it the God factor. They had a big, and I'd say probably one of the most important pieces in parenting, a two-parent structure, God's original design. You didn't have the destruction that you see, and as each generation has gone by, it's gotten progressively worse. You used to work in a prison, man. You know, just like I do, how many of those inmates that are in there come from single-parent homes?
Yeah, there's a lot of inmates that I would talk to. Especially from the black community, and they all had a similar upbringing for the most part.
Yep.
But it was also something that they all joined in on, where they themselves agreed and would even talk about, you know, it was because I didn't have a father that I turned to a father figure in gangs.
Yep. And see, and we did the same thing. I'm ashamed to admit this, because I hope my mom never hears what I'm about to say. Because I didn't have my dad there, I had friends that had older brothers. And the male figures in our lives that taught us things were pimps, street people, street hustlers. I didn't get into selling drugs. I was raised predominantly, you know, by a Christian mom. So there were certain things that I just wouldn't do. But my friends, the guys that I consider friends, I'm telling you, their dads weren't around, they had older brothers, or there were guys in the neighborhood that were willing to teach us stuff. And it was easy to turn to them because we wanted a father figure. We didn't even know at the time that that's what was missing. It took me years to figure out. I got a best friend that's in Michigan now. He's a pastor. He happens to pastor a church over in Canada, but he still lives in Michigan. I couldn't figure out, it took me, Doug, I'm 52 years old, man. It took me till I was 50 years old to figure out why. Every time I went to his house, it felt different. They lived outside of the city. His mother was a teacher at my school, and it hit me. And I told him about it. I said, man, it felt safe when I used to go to your house. I can remember his father, when we were out acting a fool, his father would just simply come in. Hey, he pointed my friend, I don't want to say his name, he'd say, I need to talk to you. Hey, and he'd look at me, company, time is over. And I'm like, oh, shoot. He's like, oh, I got to go talk to my dad. The friends that I knew that had their fathers had very different paths of life. Some of them ended up on a police force like I did. Some of them, it was amazing when I look back at how they didn't do some of the stupid things that we did.
But growing up, being like that, how did that make you a better police officer to the youth that you then policed? Because within communities, you know the saying, the community polices the police, and the police the community.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that all pan out for you?
For me, I don't know, for me, man, it was, I guess I was destined to do it. When I was a little boy, I loved cop shows. I loved Hill Street Blues. I always wanted to be a cop. I don't even know where that came from.
I like Chips. That was a big deal.
One.
I always wanted a motorcycle.
Beretta, Starsky and Hutch. I'm a little older than you, so yeah. Starsky and Hutch was out. And I would go in the house and watch Hill Street Blues while all my friends were still outside playing. It used to come on Wednesday night in Detroit. I loved it. I told my mom at 10 years old I was going to be a policeman one day. She's like, oh, no, I want you to do something else. You know what? It was just a calling. For me, because I can remember as a small child, the police coming to our home all the time. When my dad was being violent.
Domestic calls.
When my mom got injunctive order after injunctive order. And they would come back and forth. I remember how scared I used to be. And I'd feel good when the cops would show up. Because my dad would either run or they'd chase him. They'd lock him up, take him to the mental health place. And we'd get a little bit of peace. I decided at an early age that I wanted to be a guy that made some little kid feel safe. That's a true story, man. You know what? There's two things that was written. I'd say the two hardest things I ever had to do was be a father and a husband because I didn't see it in my home. What I did see, though, when I was a kid, there were a few police officers that I had contact with. One, I was 10 years old. This cop came to our neighborhood, and he used to teach self-defense classes. Man, I thought, and he was on the, I don't know if you ever saw it, but up in the Midwest, they'd have McGruff commercials. Take a bite out of crime.
Oh, yeah.
He was on the commercials. I don't want to say his name because I don't have permission to say his name. But I thought he was the coolest dude in the world. He took an interest in my brother and I and some other kids in the neighborhood, and he would teach us not how to just go out and beat people up, but he taught us self-defense, how to escape in case we were kidnapped or somebody attempted to kidnap us. There was a cop in my high school that I thought, because we actually had a police detail in my high school, he would sit down and talk with me, man. He would just, and he was always uplifting. There was another cop that my mom knew. He had a motorcycle, and he would come by, and he would take me on motorcycle rides. And they tried to keep myself and my brother out of the street. And the men in our lives that really paid special attention to us, several of them happened to be cops. And I just, man, I know what it did for me. It made me feel, it gave me a sense, almost a sense of purpose to go into police work.
But the thing about that that's so interesting is that, and I've had my similar experiences, especially when I worked in Camden, New Jersey.
Ooh.
And when I worked in Camden, it was the murder capital of the U.S.
Sure was.
And I would be on patrol. And, of course, federal is different than city.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would be doing my gig, and I remember coming across a little girl who had fallen off her bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped. I helped her get back on her bicycle. She scuffed up her knee a little bit. It was summer. And I got my little medic kit out. I cleaned up her knee. I put a Band-Aid on her. I put her back on her little bike. And I watched her, you know, get back on the sidewalk and keep going. And that's when I noticed I was in the hood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I noticed how many different people were looking at me mm-hmm. in a very awkward way. It made me feel awkward. Like if I just did something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Where I come from a predominantly white area.
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting about that is that the reaction is different for people from different parts of the states, from inner city to
yep.
me being way out in the sticks where I'm from. And for me, I just saw a little girl hurt. I just picked her up. But if you look at the history within that area, there's a lot of police abuse.
Mm-hmm.
There was, and you know, there's always that speculation going back and forth of cops that were abusive and then cops that were good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things you just navigated around. You know, in my mind was, always do the right thing. You're not going to be looked as the bad person. But that wasn't reality.
Right.
They always looked at me as a threat every single time. And it was strange because you would try to project that, hey, I'm a nice guy. You know, I'm trying to be Mr. Nice Cop over mm-hmm. here. But interacting with the younger men was always bad, almost always bad. And I found that they were trained within their gangs to be that way, mm-hmm. especially towards cops. You didn't want to be viewed as a snitch.
Right.
You know, and I'm sure you experienced that.
Oh, yeah, they had a saying where I'm from. You know, if somebody was talking to us, if there was somebody that got killed, somebody got shot or assaulted or a crime happened, and we'd ask somebody if they'd seen anything, a guy would come out and yell, "Snitches get stitches!" And the guy said, "Hey, man, I'll talk to you around the corner if you pull in the alley." They didn't want to talk to us in front of the neighborhood. You know, for me, I know of some stories where people had bad interaction with the police. But I can tell you about my experience. I had mostly good interactions with cops. I had a few scary ones. I had a big knife on me one time, and I was at my high school, and I was coming out of this program, and they had a police unit called the Big Four, and they'd get this little Dodge Diplomat. Maybe one was in uniform, the three were in plain clothes, but they had a reputation of smacking people around with, you know, nightsticks or the leather knuckle blackjacks. And I never will forget, man, this cop got out and he grabbed me. He says, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going home." He says, "What's this in your pocket?" I said, "A knife." He said, "I'll tell you what, let's look at it this way. You got it, now I got it." And he pulled it out of my pocket. "You got a problem with it?" I said, "No, sir." And he sent me home. Where I come from, Doug, either you become part of the problem or you become part of the solution. I was in my first police shootout when I was 4. They shot it out in front of my house. But I understood, maybe because my mom helped me understand, they were shooting at some guys that were doing some really bad stuff. So we moved out of there. I didn't grow up with the fear of the police because I didn't really do, I mean, I did some things that were wrong, but I just didn't have that fear of them because I had had contact with some really cool cops. Now, there were people in my neighborhood that had bad experiences, but I can't really say, you know, and part of the difference is, you know, I used to hear all the stuff about white cops doing this. Most of the cops in my neighborhood was black. You know, Detroit is largely African-American. So growing up, and I'm not saying that, now there were some black cops that beat some people up or did some, it's when the cops came down my street and they'd say, "Get off this corner," I didn't argue with them. I went home.
Which is not what you see nowadays.
Well, a few guys argued and they got smacked around. So I didn't argue with them. I just went on home. But you know what? The difference for me was the biblical upbringing. You know, my mom taught us right from wrong. And she taught us right from wrong from the scriptures. I later learned Romans chapter 13. Which lets me know that civil authorities are not a terror to people of good conduct. So if you do wrong, you should be afraid, the scripture says. But all my life I heard of people that I actually never saw. And don't get me wrong. Now, when I got on the police department, there were some bad cops out there. But it was not as many as people make it out to be. And they were black, they were white. There were some black cops that got burned for doing some you know, selling drugs, robbing dope dealers. There were a few white cops that did some things, but mostly I didn't grow up fearing the police. When I became the police, now okay, Detroit is basically, there's the west side, there's the east side, then there's the southwest side. For some reason, everybody on the east side hated the police. I mean, extremely contemptuous of the police. We'd ride by and just say hi. They'd flip us off. I'm like, what the heck? I used to see people run from us. I said, what are you running for? Well, I was scared. I'm thinking, scared of what? You're only scared if you did something. On the east side of the city, there were a lot of kids who hated us just because of the uniform I wore. Same complexion. I mean, I used to have black people say, "You just pulled me over because I'm black." I'm like, what? I'm like, are you serious? No, I pulled you over because you ran a stop sign and your license tag is expired. Do you happen to have a driver's license? Oh, it's suspended. Okay. Then it was, "You're taking me to jail because I'm black." And we'd say, okay, yeah, we're taking you to jail because you're black.
Yeah.
But I personally, most of my experiences were good experiences. And the police came to my rescue a lot because of the domestic situation we had. And I wanted to be, and I remember telling somebody how scared I was of my dad and the violence that went on at home and how good I would feel when a cop showed up. And I said, there's a lot of kids out there that are in danger. And I would really like to be that guy to give some kid that reassurance, that peace of mind, at least for one night.
So because you said that, let's segue into a really good conversation that me and you have all the time. What is it that turns kids bad that the politicians do the most? When they say defund police,
say
all, you know, ACAB, all cops are, you know, the B word.
Pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon, all that stupid stuff.
This mentality really propped up big within the white community.
Yeah.
Whenever Donald Trump started to run for office, which to me, it's funny how one man can expose the evil of a nation.
Yep.
If you would have put yourself back in uniform and you would have accompanied me to Portland Even during the Black Lives Matter rallies or protests or riots, it was white kids.
Yeah.
And, I mean, not just your average run-of-the-mill white kid. It was radicalized communist.
Yeah.
In this, I mean, reading from the Little Red Book, the Communist Manifesto, but I'm sure what they said to you on the police force, it may be the same, but I don't think it really is, because the gang culture is a tribalistic thing.
Right.
What we're seeing now in America with this communist movement, mm-hmm. it's an entirely new thing that's been here before.
Mm-hmm.
It was here during the hippie generation.
Yep.
But this is a completely different thing, because these are terroristic actions that we are seeing now. Yep. And if you take 1990s policing
mm-hmm.
and use that same style of policing versus 2020 riots, you would have seen a different aspect. I mean, mm-hmm. were we using riot control agents every night almost? Were we out there getting into use of force scenarios constantly, mm-hmm. arresting people, running down people, finding? But whenever we ran them down, search incident to arrest, guess what we were finding? Some sort of a communist manifesto.
Yeah.
And then there would be the ACLU right there videotaping you. They would have their little legal representatives writing down everything that you said. And then you would find giant Bowie knives on them. You would find explosives on them. You would find chains on them. You know, I mean, and all these things were melee objects that they would use mm-hmm. against us or against random citizens who protested against them.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I think the culture has changed.
It has.
But the violence stayed the same.
Well, you know, Doug, what happened with Black Lives Matter, all of this Marxism, Black Lives Matter is a Marxist movement.
Absolutely. They say it.
Don't let anybody tell you any different. The founders of it are witches. This was what we saw in 2020 was all planned. Now, I left the police force in 2004. If you had told me in 2004, fast forward to 2020, that we would see what we saw in cities like Dallas, I'm looking at the TV.
All right, sorry for the interruption for that. This is a house filled full of children. So if you hear screaming children in the background, that is mine, and I do apologize for it. But back to what we were talking about.
Yeah, if you'd have told me that we would have actually seen people getting beaten, killed, property being burned, and the police across the street watching it.
Not doing
and
anything.
Not intervening. I would have said you crazy. I'm stunned that I actually witnessed this, but you know how I know how this happened. It was a planned event. They all want to talk about George Floyd and that kind of thing. This happened, and black people fell for it. What am I talking about? The defund the police. Because of the situation with George Floyd, which I think we talked about that earlier. Everybody just turned into saying it was racism, racism, racism. Forgetting the fact that one of the cops was black, the other officer, there was an Asian officer, a black officer, and two white officers. I'm going to go out and say this, and I got to talk to my people. I'm not saying that every scenario, the way it happened, was necessarily ideal. But if George Floyd had not been high on illegal drugs, committing a crime, he wouldn't have got the police called on him. I'm not saying that what happened to him was right. I mean, yeah, the guy was high. Was he high on fentanyl? He was high on meth.
Which, fentanyl alone, I mean, that's a killer.
It's crazy. And what bothers me with Black Lives Matter is I policed Detroit for 10 years. I saw murder all day long. And you name it, all types of murder.
Not just murder. Gun battles.
Gun battles. A guy drove me up in the middle of a shootout. Guys in the middle of a shootout shooting at each other. I've witnessed this. Women being, we've come to scenes where women were sliced and diced. I mean, stabbed up, shot up. I've seen the destruction of the human body in ways that most people only see on the battlefield in war. Where was Black Lives Matter then? Why is it that when a black felon, while committing a crime, gets police contact and he dies while violently is resisting arrest, why is it all of a sudden we make martyrs out of them? I can tell you years where there were 800 homicides in Detroit. 500. When I was a teenager, when I was 16 years old, 1985, 86, it made national news because there were 365 young black males, they say, that were killed that year. So that's one for every day of the year. As horrible as that is, if all they had were 365 murders in Detroit now, that would be an improvement. Just let that sink in.
That's insane.
But let it, it's true. I saw my rookie year while I was coming out of the academy. I went to the Wayne County Morgue where they were doing autopsies, and our academy class was supposed to go, and then they canceled it. So a buddy of mine said, let's go to the morgue anyway. I'll never forget this as long as I live, Doug. I walked in and the guy says, oh, you guys are academy recruits. Okay, well, congratulations. He was black. Myself and the other guy happened to be black. And he looked at us. He said, I want to show y'all something. And he took us into a meat locker. Before he opened the door, I smelled the scent of like meat. I walked into this room and there were 55 bodies on the slab in that room. There were only two females. One was in her 70s, died of natural causes. One was 2 years old, a baby. The only white person in that morgue was a white guy that had a collar on because he broke his neck in a car accident. The rest of them were all black males between the ages of 16 and 23. I was 23 years old, or 24. Yeah, I was 24. That was 1993. I had just turned 24 2 days before I went to the academy. He looked me straight in the face, the guy giving us the tour. He said, you see who's all in here, don't you? And he said, when you guys get out there, and then he looked at me. He said, make sure you make a difference. And I'm like, I never forgot the smell of that room. And I looked in there, and as I looked at those bodies, some of them were kids, man. They were 16, they were 15. All I saw was broken, empty promises.
Was it mainly gang-related?
And it was gang-related, street-related, you name it, drug-related, and they were...
Not natural causes?
No, none of them were natural causes. All the young black men were all shot. They were all murder victims. All of them. So there were 55 bodies. Two of them were females. One was in her 70s. She died of natural cause. The guy says, yeah, she died of natural cause. One was a little kid. She died of SIDS. I think she was a year and a half, almost two. And it was a white guy, and I'm seeing a white male who had broke his neck. He looked to be in his 30s. The rest of them, all gunshot. Now, that was in 1993. When Black Lives Matter came on the scene, what ticked me off, because I would sit there, what ticked me off about them were, I wanted so bad to ask, where were y'all in the inner cities when black folks are killing other black folks? Ain't no, everybody loves to holler Klan and white supremacy. I'm from Detroit. There ain't no white people shooting black folks up there. Those are black folks doing that. If black lives really matter, why aren't you guys in there doing your drug intervention, interdiction programs? Where are all these programs that are geared toward getting people away from violence? I'll tell you why they weren't there. Because Black Lives Matter is just a Marxist group. They don't care anything about black people. Has nothing to do with black people. Look, they're doing an investigation now on the leadership. They can't find them. They bought some property. They took off and bought mansions. One of the ladies was funneling money to her boyfriend or her baby's dad.
They bought a communist headquarters compound in Canada?
Yes. See, Black Lives Matter, Antifa, all of them are part of the same movement. This was planned. They hijacked the death of George Floyd, and so many black people fell for it. I remember talking to a relative of mine saying, look at all those people marching with us. I'm like, they're marching with us?
We had co-workers.
Yes, we did. And I told you about that.
We had co-workers who were right there, lockstep with them, and would get into arguments with me over Black Lives Matter.
They got in arguments with me too, Doug.
Well, I mean, and I'm sitting there going like, listen, guys, I don't know if you're going to the rallies, but I'm going to the riots.
Yep.
And what I'm seeing is nothing peaceful. There's no, you cannot tell me you're out here making a difference when you are burning down schools, when you're burning down police precincts.
And I'm sitting here in amazement. People in, what, Minnesota are surrendering the police precinct. I never forget, I said this to another officer with Homeland Security. I said, I saw the videos of a guy clubbing an officer in the head with a 2x4 out in Seattle. Another one hit a guy with a hammer. They were literally attacking officers. These are all...
That was in Portland. That was us.
Yes.
That was us.
But it was somebody on your crew. I won't mention his name. And then I'm watching them try to set fire to the federal courthouse. I'm going, these are all lethal force scenarios. Why is nobody firing on these people?
Can you use deadly force in an arsonery situation?
Yes, you can.
Can you use deadly force if it's a hard object striking the head?
Yes, you most certainly can.
And I know for a fact, being a use of force instructor, the scenarios that I was taught to teach students,
yep,
that if you see this, and you know, one of the scenarios is you're walking through a park, there's a person laying on the ground, and the other guy is more or less curb stomping the victim.
Yep.
You have a split second decision of to say, you know, police, stop what you're doing, and then pull your gun and attempt to stop a murder, because it could be the next hit that killed them. And that's when we talk about hesitation, killing people. This is my problem with George Floyd. Mm-hmm. What happened was horrible. Should it have happened? No. Mm-hmm. However, the hesitancy in young officers that we saw, and I experienced it with my young officers and fellow officers that were out there in Portland and all these other places, mm-hmm, where there would be a violent action happening,
yep,
some sort of a deadly force situation or some sort of a violent use of force situation, and they would freeze because they don't want to get in trouble, they don't want to get investigated, they don't want to lose their job, they don't want the Riot Act being read to them, they don't want to be charged by the state,
yep,
or by the feds, they don't want the Black Lives Matter groups then going to their house. Yep. Everyone was scared.
Yep, they were handcuffed. And you know, I'm just going to say this. This is a spiritual problem.
Absolutely.
And I said it before and I'll say it now. What bothers me with the church, or let me just go this route. The quote-unquote black church, which I don't believe in. There's only one church. That's the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ. How did so many black people get sucked into this?
Well, let's bring up Louis Farrakhan.
Yep, he's another one. But where I'm going with this is, I'm from the inner city. You go to Detroit, there are churches on every corner. There are sometimes churches that share a common parking lot. But you can walk out in certain parts. There's famous Woodward Avenue in Detroit and see hookers out in front of the church. Something is wrong. Most black people in the inner city suffer from what I call spiritual schizophrenia. What I mean by that is I grew up in church my whole life and I believed what I was taught. And I was taught by some really good people. Some years later, I was at another ministry, big ministry in the Detroit area, on fire for God, Bible teaching, Bible thumping. I'm like, yes, I like this. But I would watch black Christians dance around. They would teach the word and say, oh, I believe this, I believe that. And they know right from wrong. And then they would run out and give their vote to somebody who promises to do exactly what our Bible teaches us is wrong. And I sat there for years and I'm thinking, and I would start having conversations with some of them, like, why are y'all voting? Why? Like, 98% of the black people that I know that voted for Obama only did so because he was black.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that say about them? 2 Chronicles 19:1 is the story of Jehoshaphat returning from battle with King Ahab. And then there was a prophet that went to him and said, should you help the ungodly and love those that hate the Lord? What does that translate to? Why are, and he went on to say, In so doing, you brought wrath upon yourself. The black community supports everything ungodly. They've supported the LGBT community. They've supported Marxist policies. They've stood by and turned their head. While 60% of those abortions, those 60 or 70 million abortions, are all black babies. Now, not that that's where I'm going. All babies are important. All lives matter. That's the Bible I read. But I know black people who are staunchly against abortion, against the LGBT agenda, against all of these things, but they voted for Obama. And when I asked them why, you're a Christian, but why would you support somebody whose policies are antithetical to the gospel that you say you believe? You know what they said? Hey, man, it's time for one of us to get in there. One of us. So black people have been conditioned. I don't even know how to break them out of it. They're supporting Democrat policies that are destroying their cities. Because black people have supported wickedness, the hood is cursed. Our community is cursed. The Bible tells us in Hosea 4, we love to read, and in black church circles, they love to talk about, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And they stop reading there. And it says, if you keep reading, because there's no knowledge of God in the land, and because you have forgotten the law of your God, I will forget your children. That's why there's so many school shootings. That's why there's so many murders. We have brought a curse upon ourselves because we know right from wrong. And right and wrong don't change. Black people know. In black community, there's churches everywhere. And there's some good Bible teachers. You can by accident stumble upon the difference between right and wrong. And it amazed me for years, even members of my own family that supported Obama. And I would tell them, hey, he supports this. He's going to give all this money to NARAL, Planned Parenthood, whose founder, by the way, hated black people, who Hillary Clinton said was her hero, Margaret Sanger. She was a guest speaker on a regular basis at Klan rallies.
She was a fan of Adolf Hitler.
Right, exactly. Black people have embraced a party that is filled with all types of ungodliness.
And you know, here's one thing that doesn't support that it surprises me, and then it doesn't surprise me, but to also support Democrats who want to take your guns away from you, but the deacons, the story that you
deacons
that you,
of defense,
the deacons defense. Of defense down in Louisiana,
yep,
who were World War II veterans,
yep,
tired of the Klan and police abuse,
yep,
and which was prominent back then in that area.
Yes, it was.
And they used their firearms, their God-given right given to them by the Constitution,
yep, to protect black pastors,
yeah,
during the civil rights movement. And you know what? And the funny part is, people don't know this other secret, or it's not a secret. They couldn't buy ammo in the South. The NRA sold the Deacons for Defense the ammo. The NRA stepped up and said, look, we'll sell you the ammo to protect yourselves because the Second Amendment applies to you just as much as it does to everybody else. You would know that by today. I know black people in Detroit. I know black people there that like, wait a minute, man, we got to have guns to protect ourselves.
Well, where do they get the guns?
What, you mean the street people or? Oh, man, gun is the easiest thing to get. I always said if guns are made illegal, the only people that will have them is law enforcement and criminals. This whole thing about gun control is smoke and mirrors. Take me to a city I've never been to. All I need to do is find out where the drugs are sold and I can get a gun. It's just that easy. Gun laws are... Gun confiscation or gun control don't apply to the criminals. It is a big sham. And the Democratic Party knows it. Take me to any city, any major city. That's all I need to do. I knew that being at gun bans. I was a police officer during the first assault weapons ban. Doug, we were getting Uzis, AK-47s, and I'm going, man, look at, I got a 16-year-old kid with an H&K pistol.
But automatics, though, not just single shot.
Oh, brother, they had M16s. They had fully automatic weapons. But these were street purchases.
But where do those come from?
I'll tell you, in Detroit in particular, you know the story, they had a story about a guy named White Boy Rick.
Mm-hmm.
Rick, I can't remember his last name. Okay, the real deal is, because I grew up there, I know the story. White Boy Rick was a white guy in the hood that sold drugs. White Boy Rick's father had a military connect. White Boy Rick's father sold M16s during the early 90s to the drug dealers. He was the gun guy. He had a connect where he would get military arms, fully automatic weapons. I don't even know where he got them from. They never disclosed it.
That the police department didn't have.
The police department didn't have. Man, when I joined the police department, we had M1A1 rifles, World War II relics, 30 caliber, and there was some 30-06s. These guys on the street had fully automatic M16s. He supplied the entire East Side, all the drug dealers there with weapons, so they loved him. White Boy Rick's father, who I think he's passed away now, but White Boy Rick got out of jail. That's where he supplied the city's East Side full of guns. But I can go back to Detroit now. I know where the drugs are being sold because I grew up there. All, if I got the money...
So you mean nothing's changed?
Nothing's changed. So if they do gun control, the only difference is citizens will be stripped of their armament and their right to protect people. And what's so shocking about black folks falling for this defund the police thing, that's another stupid move. What's the first thing to go when they defund the police? I'll tell you. Most departments are underfunded anyway. The first thing to go is staff. So they fire all the people in the academy. So all of these people that are leaving due to retirement or whatever, nobody's replacing these people that are leaving through attrition. The second to go is training. You got a taser? Every 2 years, you got to get trained and qualified and recertified with your taser. Oh, we're defunding. So they take away the money for the tasers. They got to take the tasers away from the officers. Third to go is your specialized units. Your sex crimes units, your robbery homicide, your special victims, even your sex trafficking units. Plainclothes assignments. I used to work special operations. We did fugitive apprehensions, all that. That means we would have been gone. Everybody's back in uniform. Well, those guys that work narcotics, those guys that work vice, that's got 20 years on, they're like, I ain't going back to uniform. Forget that. They put their papers in and they leave. So now you got all of these people on the street. What these people who bought the defund scam didn't realize is all the people who really know how to fight crime, the same officers that will look at what they're doing now and say, we're not going to bother people who are peacefully protesting. But no, that guy threw a bottle, arrest him. The guys who recognize and understand that they don't have to follow an unlawful order, an unconstitutional order, those are the ones that are leaving. So you got all these kids now, and you got all these people that, man, some of them got mortgages and they're still a little scared. They're going to go to uniform, and you know what they're going to do? Scout 9-5, we got to fight at Gratiot and Chalmers. Those are streets in Detroit. Yeah, we're en route from traffic. I've seen it done. We're going to pull a guy over and find a reason to write him a ticket. I'm not going to that fight because I know, man, that's a big fight. I'm by myself. I got another car coming with me. Or we really are scared to get involved in fights and stuff that'll turn ugly on us.
But turn ugly how?
Okay. Depending on, if you know the layout of your precinct, in which we did, there's certain houses and certain neighborhoods, certain streets. Oh, shoot. They're fighting again. We had neighbors that used to shoot it out with each other. Those officers know, oh, shoot. We go over there, we're going to get in a shootout. And now is not the time to get in a shootout. Ain't nobody over there but black people. And the white officers were scared even back in the 90s and early 2000s. I've seen them. They get accused of being racist because they shoot a guy that tries to shoot them. Oh, it was racist. They were doing that in Detroit in the late 90s, early 2000s. It just didn't make the national headlines like it's doing now. But those cops are like, wait a minute. Why should I get involved? Okay, they're sending me to this robbery or a big fight at a bar. Or let's say the popular bar where all the drug dealers hang out. We know that if you wait 5 minutes, when you get there, hey, the losers go to the hospital and the winners are probably already gone. When you defund the police, they're understaffed. Now you got guys that are overworked, stressed out. Cops are in record numbers around the country taking sick leave, stress leave.
And the PTSD that is within policing is not talked about because, and Joe Rogan had a guy on his show and they talked about this, that even within policing, the amount of crap that you see per day, it's not like within our brothers that are in the fire department where they get 2 or 3 days off to decompress.
Yep.
You have to do this every single day, especially if you're forced overtime and you got to work another
like 8 hours.
Yeah. You know, and you don't get a, you don't get the ability to decompress. You just keep getting inundated with violence.
I was told by a military vet that I had PTSD. I didn't even recognize it. I was in 2 shootings. One of them was a shootout. One, I had to shoot a person that was getting ready to stab another officer. And the shootout that I was in, oh my gosh, it was a crazy guy opened fire on us from a truck in the middle of a snowstorm. We're shooting back at him. I was so wired for days after that. I walked around paranoid. If I saw somebody with their hands in their pocket, I was freaking out. I was carrying extra magazines on me. And a military vet told me, he said, AJ, you got PTSD. I said, no. But we literally went from fight to fight, violence, shooting. I can remember nights where we only had 3 cars work in our precinct in July because everybody's on vacation. We had a double shooting on the north end of the precinct, triple shooting on the south end. Okay, we got a fight in progress. Shots are being fired. And we literally, that was our night. And I'm sitting there like, oh my gosh, this is crazy.
Which call to prioritize? Like,
right. And I can remember the dispatcher saying, I worked at the 9th precinct, cars in number 9. We're getting multiple calls at such and such address. We got multiple shots being fired. Okay, this ticket, we got people lying down in the street. We got multiple people shot. And they would ask, where are you? I'm still on this fatal accident. Take a pull. Get over to that. I mean, we would literally run from one violent act to the next, or one scene of carnage to the next. And then I'm telling you, that's why cops drink, man.
And then you're supposed to go home and have a good 8 hours of sleep.
Oh, my gosh.
And do it all over again. I remember as a cop, man, I think I slept 4 hours a night. Man. And I was stressed out all the time.
It's like, I my wife will tell you, she did not want me to get back into police work after I moved to Texas. I realized I had become something. I was harsh. My tolerance for anything that I considered stupid at home was up. Like, no. I mean, well, you know, cops, we like to be in charge, and we don't like it when we're not in charge. Because if you lose it out on the street, you lose everything.
Yeah.
So.
You lose that street cred.
Right. And it's like, I couldn't turn the switch off. I literally could not turn the switch off. Now, I usually got to sleep most nights okay. But there were some nights where I was up, you know, there were some nights where I lost some comrades. And I didn't sleep well.
Yeah.
But, you know, these people, back to the defund thing, these cities that did that, that fell for that, who is suffering the most? The communities that they claim that the defunding would help. Well, all these politicians, they still have their police details.
Oh, yeah.
Their security.
Oh, yeah.
And look at New York. They're throwing people in front of subway trains. There's no transit cops down there. The stabbings are through the roof. And all that mayor wants to talk about is gun violence. I'm like, wait a minute, you got a violence problem. Rapes, murders, shootings, it's a free-for-all. Chicago, I mean, the cops are like, look, man. Well, the Chicago cops that I know have retired since then, but when I see the pictures of them, I can just see the stress in their face. Like, what the heck am I doing here now? I mean, Mayor Lightfoot sent them out in the middle of a riot when they were trying to tear down the statue of Christopher Columbus. No riot gear.
Yep.
They were stabbing officers with sharpened PVC pipe. And I'm sitting here going, I would not have gone out. I would have set fire at me. I'm like, I'm not going out there with no riot gear.
So we're going to have to stop right there. We're almost right at the...
I'm sorry, I talked too long.
At the end of it. Ladies and gentlemen, what you've been listening to is two cops talking about, you know, cop problems. Stuff that you typically don't get to hear. You're not going to get to hear this on Fox News or CNN. If you like what you're hearing, send me an email, AmericanVindictaShow.com. And let me know. Me and AJ are going to have a few more conversations like this because police have been demonized across the nation, and I'm trying to build back the reputation, but at the same time, we're losing it again in Canada, man.
Oh, yeah.
We're losing it all around the world. So
that's a shame what's going on.
It is. And we're going to talk about it on the next episode. So stay tuned to the next episode. My name is Doug Thornton. You've been listening to American Vindicta. We're out. All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.